Lecture 24, The Future of Espionage.
On May 2, 2011, American helicopters with Navy SEALs clattered towards Abbottabad, Pakistan. Notice how the very name of the place, Abbottabad, resonates with the themes of our course. That city's name is not an ancient Pakistani one. Rather, it was named for Sir James Abbott, one of the British administrators on the frontier of British India from the 1830s to the 1850s. Abbott had been an early player in the great game of Central Asian competition played by Kim, the fictional boy spy hero of Rudyard Kipling's novel of the same name. The helicopters touched down at a compound which CIA analysts had pinpointed over long months of investigation as the likely hiding place of the chief of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden. The mission had been rehearsed repeatedly in advance, in a specially built mock-up of the targeted compound. Now the mission, however, was real. A firefight broke out, lasting 40 minutes, and bin Laden was killed. The helicopters took off again and flew away. The mission was executed by the Joint Special Operations Command, a grouping of special units tasked with secret missions. This institution is estimated to cost more than $1 billion annually. Together, the Joint Special Operations Command and the CIA were able to put together a mission that took many months to bring to fruition. Bin Laden had disappeared in Afghanistan in 2001, and many surmised that he was living somewhere in a remote cave, far away from civilization. CIA analysts in 2007 began to concentrate on a man they supposed was a courier for bin Laden, whose movements, tracked carefully, might lead them to the Al-Qaeda leader. In the summer of 2010, the first clues were identified, and the courier was eventually traced to a compound in Abbottabad, a busy urban setting, not a mountain cave. The compound appeared to have no phone or internet hookup. The CIA placed agents nearby in a neighboring house to observe the compound. Far overhead, spy satellites peered into the compound and spotted a tall man walking in the grounds who might be bin Laden. But even then, it was not completely clear. One CIA analyst rated the chances in advance at about 80% certainty. This historical event shows some enduring patterns that have echoed throughout our survey of espionage and covert actions. First, such activities are expensive and require tremendous organization. In fact, the United States in 2010 is estimated to have spent $80 billion on intelligence activities. Second, just as we've been tracing in this course the growing importance of SIGINT, signals intelligence, and the role of technology, they played a role here too, with satellites and military aircraft. Of that $80 billion that I just mentioned spent by the U.S. in 2010 on intelligence, it's estimated that 85% of those funds went to technology, like spy satellites and computers. The third point. In spite of this emphasis on technology and SIGINT, HUMINT and the role of the individual human agent and analyst was still indispensable in this operation. Because the compound lacked phone or internet connections, human observation would still be needed on the ground. Fourth, this secret operation was hidden not only from the target, but also from the country in which the compound was located, Pakistan, even though that country was a putative ally in the war on terror. We've seen before in this course that spying goes on all the time, in peace and in war, and against friends and allies, not only against declared foes. The fifth point, and a crucial one, suggests that success or accuracy was not certain until the very end. Espionage and covert actions have retained that element of risk and uncertainty that they have always had. In this, our final lecture, we focus on the continuing appeal of the myth of the spy, in fact and in fiction, the role of the spy in a larger social and political context, and we also speculate on future trends that can already be discerned in current news. So, have espionage and the secret world lost their relevance in our own times? We need to conclude, in fact, that if anything, their relevance has grown and continues to grow. In this course, we've seen the world of espionage change radically due to the application and proliferation of SIGINT, the impact of technologies that made real-time intelligence, which could be acted upon speedily, and which was so elusive to the pre-modern age, it's now a reality in modern times. As a result, the scope of spies, spying, and covert operations has expanded. In this computer age, the ordinary individual who in earlier times might have been under the radar can now be tracked, data crunched, and observed as never was possible before. And not only by governments, but also by marketers, economic analysts, hackers, or reporters looking for a story or a sensational scoop, and countless others. To take an example, we should mention economic or industrial espionage, which often sees companies or corporations, not governments, spying on each other for trade secrets and market advantage. What's at stake here is not so much national security or defense, but market share. And yet, economic espionage is nothing new. It has likely been around since the ancient merchants that we discussed all the way back in our second and third lectures in this course. The information that was gathered on his own score by a merchant adventurer like Marco Polo has to be credited to this account. Economic espionage also ran in tandem with the shadowy operations of the Cold War. In 1965, for example, Sergei Pavlov, the representative for the Soviet airline Aeroflot, was arrested in France, and he was found to be carrying plans of the sophisticated technical innovations of that pride of French high industry, the Concorde transatlantic jet. In our own time, let's just let one example stand in for many others. In 2009, two employees of a British tire company were alleged in 2007 to have tricked their way into a Goodyear tire factory in Kansas to take photographs of the machinery that was being used to make large off-road tires for gigantic earth-moving equipment. They were alleged to have then mailed those photographs to their own company's factory in Britain to reproduce this cutting-edge technology. An allied and long-term phenomenon which we have seen has been the increasing use of technology in espionage, absolutely indispensable to the rising importance of SIGINT. In fact, this has led to yet another bewildering acronym, ELINT, for electronic intelligence. Consider, for example, the spy satellite and its crucial role starting in the 1960s. The spy satellite was an advance on the earlier U-2 spy planes and increasingly outpaced what these spy planes were capable of, while also eliminating the personal risk that someone like Gary Powers, who had been shot down in 1960, had to run on a regular basis in his overflights. Spy satellites would be especially important in gathering information about a closed society, like the Soviet Union during the Cold War, or North Korea in the present day, where infiltrating or recruiting a human spy inside those regimes would be staggeringly difficult by comparison. A regular spy race involved the construction of these spy satellites. First was the shock of the Sputnik moment in 1957, when the Soviets had jumped ahead and had launched the world's first satellite into orbit. By August 1960, the United States was operating the Corona satellite, which gained photographic coverage of the Soviet Union as it streaked by overhead at high altitude and then parachuted the negatives of the photographs it had taken to the ground. The National Reconnaissance Office and the Department of Defense was put in charge of this intelligence. This was the first spy satellite and operated from 1960 to 1972, and one of these satellites is on display at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington. Further, newer generations of spy satellites grew even more sophisticated and can deliver even more detailed information, zeroing in on tiny targets below. They also can deliver unexpectedly dramatic visual evidence of the big picture as well. There's a famous series of satellite pictures that were taken quite recently showing nighttime over the Korean peninsula. And the pictures include both the North and South Korean states. The prosperous South is lit up with electricity in the nighttime sky. The poorer and closed-off hermit kingdom of the North, by contrast, is bathed in darkness. It's a study in contrasts more eloquent than any number of reports or briefing documents. To satellites have also been added unmanned surveillance aircraft. These include the Predator drones, flown remotely by the American military over dangerous locations, which are able to observe from on high or rain missiles down on selected targets. The advent of the computer age increased the technological stakes still further, as attacks against government computers by hackers or by foreign agents became a real threat. Viruses and malware can lie quietly in computer systems once they've been infiltrated until they are activated to cause maximum damage. Oddly enough, this idea itself has remarkably ancient antecedents. Recall from the start of our course that durable legend from classical times of the Trojan horse and how it led to the fall of a great civilization. In fact, today, computer security experts sometimes even use the word Trojanize to describe this kind of dangerous intrusion by malware or viruses. Several recent examples illustrate this. We no longer need to speak of future cyber war or future wars by computer as if these were scenarios that will happen at some later point. They've taken place already. In 2007 and 2008, there were two instances. Russian computers were turned on Estonia and Georgia, two neighboring states, during international disputes to shut down the government websites of those smaller countries and to impede their work or attempts at public relations. Then in 2010, in a phenomenon which is still shrouded in mystery, another large-scale computer attack took place. It was concentrated against Iran. This was the launching of the so-called Stuxnet computer worm. It affected tens of thousands of computers worldwide, but had a particular task. It was designed to specifically attack software from the German Siemens company, which is used to run refineries, factories, and nuclear facilities. The worm hides itself and then sends instructions to the machinery which it controls. The worm tells the machinery to do things that will exceed the machine's capacity. And when the machines obey, they destroy themselves in the process. And this is what happened in Iran, apparently. Who was responsible for the Stuxnet worm? Speculation still runs rampant. Computer attacks are the stuff of our daily news headlines now. In May 2011, for instance, Lockheed Martin, the largest aerospace company and the Pentagon's number one supplier, had to fight off a large computer attack. And at present, government commissions investigate what should be done to protect this whole new area of special vulnerability. Another incident in the recent past has also highlighted how technology has turbocharged espionage, giving new salience to old forms of espionage. This was the so-called WikiLeaks case. In 2010, it's alleged that an Army intelligence analyst, a private first class, working in a small office in Baghdad, Iraq, downloaded more than a quarter million U.S. diplomatic cables, which he then passed to an organization called WikiLeaks, which posted publicly and distributed those documents, some of them sensitive or embarrassing in their candor for the U.S. State Department. This was one of the largest breakdowns in military security in U.S. history, and it was allegedly occasioned not by a super spy, but by a remarkably low-level employee of only 22 years old. We've certainly seen leaks before in this course over history, but there were elements here that were also new. First, the organization which received the stolen information was not a foreign government, but rather a non-governmental organization run by a computer activist, Julian Assange, who is dedicated to combating secrecy. Second, the sheer scale of the leak was enabled by technology. It's reported, allegedly, that the intelligence activists had brought to work CDs of Lady Gaga music, had erased them, and loaded the secret documents onto those CDs. The entire cache might well include half a billion words, so a massive amount of information. By way of contrast, think back all the way to the start of our course and the technology of sending messages in ancient Greece, tattooed onto the heads of slaves whose heads had been shaved, or inserted in little sealed compartments into olive oil jars in a messy expedient. The difference in the size of the information is vast. The intelligence analyst was arrested, and the WikiLeaks organization itself fell into disarray when its founder was arrested on other charges. But the questions that were raised by the case were debated heatedly, and in fact are urgent ones. Should a democracy have any secrets at all? What is the proper role of a whistleblower? Can traditional diplomacy function without confidentiality? This opens up to yet further questions that are still broader. How much spying, if any, is appropriate to a democracy? What role, if any, is there for morality in espionage and covert actions? Finally, what are the human costs of the secret world of espionage? We should take stock of future issues that are already emerging in the world of espionage, some of which we already have touched on in our later lectures in this course. First, we find ourselves today sliding into a culture of surveillance, without a lot of vigorous public conversation about this ongoing development. Just think about it. Hidden or exposed cameras can be found at schools, supermarkets, at the bank lobby, or next to the ATM machine, at intersections with busy traffic and traffic cameras, in many, many daily settings. In Britain, for instance, it's been estimated that an ordinary citizen could be captured on film by secret cameras about 300 times a day. Now, that statistic has in fact been criticized as to whether it's actually accurate, but the order of magnitude is what's suggestive here. It remains true that we are subject to surveillance in a way that earlier governments could not even have dreamed of. In some sense, the dystopia of Orwell's 1984 is technologically now approximated. One could argue that our societies today have the tools that totalitarian surveillance regimes, like those of Stalin and Hitler that we discussed earlier, would have lusted to have. And so we need to ask, doesn't this have potential dangers all its own? How is privacy affected? The dynamic is one that's actually easy for us to recognize because we see it unfolding around us daily. The term surveillance society was apparently first coined quite recently in 1985, and it's all around us. We need to say, in fact, that the modernity that we have crafted for ourselves has surveillance woven through it. Because of the increasing cheapness of memory for storage, surveillance cameras and computers are able to record ever vaster sequences of information. And then technology for facial recognition allows computers to discern and pinpoint particular individuals. And all of this is done by machine. While the labor of human watchers is difficult, tedious, and expensive, now this task has, in a sense, been outsourced to machines, as machines are used for this task of spying. Moreover, surveillance is not only by camera or by sight. Surveillance of data also is important. Data is collated between different data banks to create remarkably complete profiles of unsuspecting people. In addition, surveillance is done not only by governments, but also by businesses on a regular basis. And we also need to be clear about this. It's also done by ourselves. Think of that relatively new word, Googling. Looking up information about someone or an institution. That very act, as well as the proliferating social networking media, means that we have so many more opportunities for surveillance. To add to this phenomenon, we also need to note that now surveillance can extend, in a sense, to the past and the future, not just the present. Surveillance includes the past because records remain stored electronically. So that old joke one used to hear in high school about being threatened that things are going to go onto your permanent record that you've done is actually no longer so funny. It now is a reality. Surveillance also, in a sense, can glimpse the possible future as some fear that genetic information, which shows a person's likely later health trajectory or development, could be misused. And just to complicate things further, we need also to stress, as scholars of the phenomenon have pointed out, that not all surveillance is bad. Some of our ubiquitous surveillance actually yields a social good, as when a crime is solved, or a kidnapper is arrested, or when a government bureaucracy functions effectively in order to deliver services where they're most needed and required. So, as with all technologies, from the use of fire to the use of computers, it's always a question not so much of the technology itself, but of the human uses to which these things are put. The question we're in fact dealing with is a very old one, one which relates to the secret world we've been studying. Quis custodiet ipsos custodes is a classical Latin phrase asking, who will watch the watchers? And the answer to this question, who will watch the watchers, must be us. We need to keep a level of social awareness of possible, perhaps inevitable, abuses before us always. This is a discussion about surveillance and privacy that needs to involve everyone. Whatever happens, it seems crucial that we not just collectively sleepwalk into becoming a future society with total surveillance, but that we have a transparent and vigorous debate on this development. Second, observers of government today point out that a culture of government secrecy has been growing, which threatens to shroud in unknowing the very facts which a self-governing people need to know. The problem here is not entirely new. It was, in fact, diagnosed by Democratic Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who spoke of a culture of secrecy damaging to the American Republic. He noted that secrecy, which had its uses, could also shield the government from accountability. It could deprive the government of the facts needed to make policy and could rob the populace at large of a well-informed perspective and debate. Back when Moynihan was reporting on the problem, the government was classifying 400,000 documents every year at the highest level of secrecy and many more at lower levels. Now, in spite of legislation that was introduced in 1996 or went into effect in 1996 to make records more accessible, the problem still persists. Finally, there is the problem likely to grow larger in the future of the expectations that are placed on intelligence agencies. If there is a place for intelligence gathering and espionage in a democracy, what are its true capabilities? Intelligence professionals have complained with justice about the public's false image of what spying can really do, what kinds of information it can procure, and the kinds of levels of certainty it can achieve. There's a parallel to be observed in this sense in the justice system, where legal experts comment on what they call the CSI effect, the expectation of juries that the court will show DNA evidence and precise matches and total forensic certainty, just like in the popular TV shows. In fact, in a strange way, the belief that spies can go anywhere and find out anything is really an odd flip side of the recurring phenomenon we've observed in this course of spy panics, the conviction that spies are everywhere and all-powerful. In fact, real life is more complicated, and as we've noted, intelligence gathering is immensely expensive. A democracy should have a realistic clarity about what kinds of intelligence activities it sees as appropriate, what it expects, and what it's willing to adequately fund. As we approach the end of our course, I'd like to close with an assignment and a test. This is a course, after all. First, the assignment. You can do it anytime. The next time you see a news story about espionage or covert operations flash across the computer screen or splashed across the newspaper headlines, apply what we have learned in the course to the story. There'll be no shortage of such stories. As I had the pleasure of preparing these lectures, there were news stories about espionage in Pakistan, a spy trial in Moscow, suspicions of spying in Georgia and the Caucasus, on and on. Simply take the most recent news story and ask, Does it resemble any of the many stories we encountered over the centuries? Or is it a new story to add to those others involving the powers of cutting-edge technology? What are the motivations at play in this story? Religion, ideology, greed for money, or some complicated mix of resentments on the part of the spy? Or is the new story instead an example of another phenomenon we saw again and again, spy panics? It's my hope that our understanding of breaking news will be enriched by the long-term perspective we've gained in this course. And now for the test. Actually, everyone can relax because this is not a test of you. Rather, let us together test some of the pronouncements we have heard in this course that have been made about espionage through the ages. Let us test them and see how well or how poorly they match the fuller understanding we've achieved and how likely they are to hold up in the future. At the start of our course, the Chinese philosopher Sun Tzu had declared, "All warfare is based on deception," and he had praised the beautiful economies that sometimes could be achieved by covert action. Sun Tzu's motto stands up well, but we should add that we've seen espionage playing crucial roles not only in times of war, but in peacetime as well. So we extend his point. Then in the age of Queen Elizabeth of England, her subtle spymaster, Sir Francis Walsingham, had whispered to us this insight, "Knowledge is never too dear." Walsingham had also added that it was better to fear too much than too little so as not to be caught by surprise. We can accept this motto as well while adding that one of the challenges of our own times is not too little knowledge, but an avalanche of data, which needs keen interpretation by human analysts to find out which dear knowledge is truly most valuable. Walsingham, as always, would have listened to us quietly and then might have agreed. Now, recall an entirely different and absolute pronouncement. United States Secretary of State Henry Stimson, in 1929, had ringingly declared, "Gentlemen, do not read each other's mail." This is a beautiful counsel of perfection. In the best of all possible worlds, certainly, perfect gentlemen and gentlewomen would conduct the affairs of state in a perfectly open, transparent, and candid manner. Is this our world? Until the best of all possible worlds is achieved, would not a gentleman who neglected the arts of self-defense be left vulnerable and ineffective? Let us set Stimson's advice before us as an ideal to strive towards. Someday. More realistic, and yet characteristically eloquent, is Winston Churchill's quip that, quote, "In wartime, truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies," end quote. The key, obviously, is to keep the precious truth firmly enthroned so that the bodyguard of falsehood doesn't overwhelm the greater true objective. The danger of truth being overwhelmed by falsehood was summed up in that plaintive quote of a tortured man, James Jesus Angleton, the CIA counterintelligence expert who was haunted by the notion of betrayals within betrayals, even in his beloved institution. He called the business of the secret world a wilderness of mirrors, quoting the modernist poet T.S. Eliot. Let us accept Angleton's cautious motto. Sir Francis Walsingham would also have urged us to be well aware of all the potential dangers. Now, the grimmest pronouncement probably came from a character in John le Carré's 1963 novel, The Spy Who Came in from the Cold. His disillusioned British spy, Alec Lemus, just before his death, had shouted, quote, "What do you think spies are? Priests, saints, and martyrs? They're a squalid procession of vain fools, traitors, people who play cowboys and Indians to brighten their rotten lives," end quote. This is too sweeping a statement. In our course, we have seen any number of motivations, including those who took on secret operations out of a deep faith and conviction. Whether that was religious or ideological, and whether it was misplaced as a faith is another question. Alongside the cynics, the confused, and the frankly crazy drawn into espionage. Best of all is to add to these mottos that we examined an insight about the role of the secret world in a democracy that's most apposite to us. It's a new motto. In 1822, President James Madison declared, quote, "A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power knowledge gives," end quote. The gathering of intelligence and the acting on it can be the first line of defense of a self-ruling people, or it can be the prelude to the loss of liberties, the tragedy plus farce which Madison warned of. The best defense is an informed people. In that spirit, let me congratulate all of you on having begun to inform yourselves through this course, and I thank you for your attention.
We hope you have enjoyed these lectures from The Great Courses. Our courses are now available to order online. Visit our website at thegreatcourses.com or call our customer care representatives at 1-800-832-2412. That's 1-800-832-2412. Thank you very much.